by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass smack dab in the middle of it. Grass smack dab in the middle. We are grass smack dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, we've got one of the finest guests we've ever had before. He's coming to us from Los Angeles, and I want to welcome Jay Margolis. Welcome to our program.
Hey, thank you for having me, George.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've written this fine book about Marilyn Monroe, but first tell our listening audience a little bit about your background.
Yes, I'm a Jesse Unruh research scholar for writing a paper on African-American reparations. I graduated from the University of Southern California with a 3.91 GPA, and I have a political science background. I've always been interested in research. In the book that I wrote on Marilyn Monroe, the second one, I also have a 19-page postscript on the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Right. Well, you've really researched this extensively. And what we're talking about tonight for our listening audience, to give us a little background, we're talking about Marilyn Monroe and the murder of Marilyn Monroe. And in other words, you believe the murder of Marilyn Monroe is the name of the book, case study. It's a final closed case. Is that right? Case closed. Excuse me.
That is correct, because
How are you coming up with that title? Did you do even more research than about anyone before now?
That is correct. In fact, you know, it couldn't have been a suicide or an accidental death, because she was purported by Coroner Theodore Curfee, you know, the coroner of Los Angeles County. He purported that Marilyn swallowed approximately 47 Nebutals and 17 chlorohydrates, and he said it is our opinion. So he doesn't even know. You know, I mean, that was like his guess. And so, but the thing is, her stomach was empty. So, but she had enough drugs in her blood to kill at least three people. So that means that she didn't swallow the drugs that killed her. It means it entered in some other way besides swallowing it.
Marilyn Monroe was a major star for our younger audience out there in the 50s into the 60s until her death, of course. And she was a blockbuster star, and she was going up. At this time, I think her career was expanding, was it not?
Oh, definitely. She, you know, was rehired by Fox, and she had, you know, she was going to start reshooting Something's Got to Give, her final incomplete film with Dean Martin. And the studio tried to hide that fact that they were rehiring her, because then it would make them look bad. You know, the fact that here they are wasting all this money on Elizabeth Taylor and Cleopatra. And so, you know, they just couldn't, you know, put that in the news. It wasn't to their advantage to make Marilyn look good. So they just, you know, didn't show that.
Well, Marilyn had a couple of affairs that figure into this in a very important way. And was one of those affairs with John Kennedy earlier in the 50s somewhere, or what, late 50s or what?
Yes, he was definitely having an affair with Marilyn Monroe when he was senator. In fact, that was before he was even president. It was in the early 1950s, and that's when the affair began. And so Marilyn became excited when he had the prospect of becoming president, because then he becomes an even larger figure. And so, you know, right around after the happy birthday, Mr. President, when she went on May 19th, 1962, to go sing happy birthday to President Jack Kennedy, that's when, you know, Jack thought that he had to end this thing. So he sent his brother out to California to kind of cool Marilyn off because she didn't want to end it. And she was saying, oh, well, she was threatening to go public back then. And so Bobby Kennedy says, just cool it. And that's when, according to Peter Lawford, Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn started to have an affair. In fact, Lawford said that Marilyn and Bobby slept in Lawford's guest bedroom that night. And then a huge affair happened. And we definitely know that this is true.
So, in other words, John Kennedy had this romance with Marilyn Monroe first, and then later on, Bobby would enter the scene and have a very, very tumultuous, I guess, at the end, affair with Marilyn. Marilyn was a very, very emotional person towards the end of her life, was she not?
Oh, she was, but, you know, at the same time, you know, she expected a lot, you know, from her when she was married to her second husband, Joe DiMaggio, and then she was married to her third husband, Arthur Miller. These are huge people. You know, Joe DiMaggio, the biggest baseball player of all time. Arthur Miller, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of The Death of a Salesman. So then she looked upon Bobby and Jack, and these were, you know, really large figures in politics. And so she kind of expected the same thing. If they promised to make a commitment to her, she expected them to uphold it. In fact, I spoke to Michael Selzman, who is part of the Arthur P. Jacobs Company, it was Marilyn's publicity, and he said that he heard at the time, before her death, that yes, it is true that Bobby, according to Marilyn, had promised to marry her, that was something that was being discussed at the publicity firm.
My gosh. So that's leading up now. Also involved in this, is there a Fidel Castro angle here, and also in the mob? How do those two factors figure into Marilyn and John Kennedy and Bobby and so forth?
Well, when she was sleeping with both brothers, you know, they would disclose, you know, these like secrets, these state secrets that weren't supposed to be talked about at the time, like the plot to kill Castro. And we know that she was talking about this with them because I interviewed Organized Crime Intelligence Division Detective Mike Rothmiller, and he saw Marilyn's little red diary where she wrote all about this. She wrote about, you know, sleeping with Jack Kennedy. She wrote about sleeping with Bobby Kennedy. She wrote about the mafia. She referred to Fidel Castro as Fidel C in her red diary, according to Rothmiller. And so we know that this is true. You know, this is not just, you know, like a guess or some figment of somebody's imagination.
Right. You've got a lot of background here and a lot of evidence and a lot of witnesses over the years that knew both all these people and are Peter Lawford and so forth. Now, Peter Lawford, was he not married to a Kennedy sister or what? How was he?
Yes.
How was he involved in this?
He was married to Patricia Kennedy Lawford, and Patricia was actually a close friend of Marilyn's. You see, Marilyn didn't really have like a lot of female friends, but Pat Kennedy Lawford was like the closest that Marilyn had to a female friend. And so that was another reason that she was upset that these Kennedy brothers are, you know, reneging on their promises, is because she had such a close friendship with Pat.
Right. Now we move further along into this, and when did how did Marilyn Monroe really die? Tell us the story.
Okay, so Marilyn Monroe was murdered. She had an empty stomach at the autopsy. There was not one undissolved capsule in her stomach. I interviewed a medical professional, Elias Amador, MD, and he told me that you would expect to see undissolved capsules had she purported to have swallowed 64 pills. But that means that, you know, she was obviously a homicide. This is not an accident. You can't accidentally have enough drugs in you to kill three people. And, you know, so that effectively rules out accidental death, as even the autopsy surgeon, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, ruled out. And so people are wondering, well, who would kill Marilyn? Would it be the mafia? And the mafia is ruled out because there were actually five eyewitnesses to Marilyn Monroe's murder. There's Schaefer ambulance attendant James Hall, who said he saw Dr. Greenson stick a heart needle into her chest. The time that he saw this, he thought it was nothing sinister. He always reported it as a brownish fluid that Greenson was filling the syringe up with. That's not adrenaline. He thought it was adrenaline at the time, and so he didn't say anything. because another eyewitness, Pat Newcomb, her publicist, was the first person that James Hall saw when he arrived on the scene with his driver, Murray Leibowitz. He's another eyewitness to the murder. In fact, Pat Newcomb was directing them to the guest cottage where Marilyn was nude, face down, and leaning on the phone. And so Hall asked Pat Newcomb, her publicist, what's wrong with her? And Pat Newcomb says, I think she took some pills. And so they take her off the guest cottage bed, and they put a resuscitator on her. And then all of a sudden, Dr. Ralph Greenson, Maryland psychiatrist, comes in and says, hey, take off the resuscitator, give her positive pressure. And James Hall says, well, you don't argue with an MD. He was 22 at the time, you know, James Hall. And he says, you know, he has a wife and a kid on the way. He doesn't want to lose his job. So he listens to him, even though the resuscitator is doing its job and her color is coming back. And then Greenson takes a hypodermic syringe out of his medical bag, like a foot-long syringe, fills it with a brownish fluid, and then injects it directly into her heart, and she expires shortly afterwards. In fact, James Hall said that as Greenson was injecting her, Peter Lawford and Sergeant Marvin Einone entered the guest cottage.
Right. This psychiatrist that injected this, was that her personal psychiatrist and doctor?
Yes,
too?
It was.
Okay.
Yes, it was.
So he would know, by treating her, he would know her inner thoughts, would he not?
Yes, he would. He had special knowledge from all those sessions. There were so many different sessions. Sometimes it would be twice a day, in which he said that he would only charge her once.
Right.
But so, here's what's interesting is that Peter Lawford, he made a statement in 1983. He said, quote, he said, Marilyn has got to be silenced, Bobby told Greenson, or something to that effect. Greenson had thus been set up by Bobby to take care of Marilyn, end quote. So we have three of the five eyewitnesses saying that Greenson did it as a murder. There's Peter Lawford, who just said the quote I just stated, and there's the two ambulance attendants, you know, James Hall, and Murray Leibowitz in 1993, he told Donald Wolf that, yes, James Hall's telling the truth about the heart needle and Greenson. So there's three of the five, that's 60%, that say Greenson did it as a murder. You're probably wondering, well, why did Greenson do this? Well, see, the thing that's not commonly known is that Peter Lawford said that Greenson was having an affair with Marilyn. And so on this press conference that Marilyn was going to hold on August 6, 1962, which is 2 days after she's murdered, you know, because she threatened to expose both Bobby and Jack. So Bobby called up Dr. Greenson, and he says, look, I know you're sleeping with Marilyn, and she's going to hold this press conference exposing me and Jack Kennedy on Monday morning, but she's also going to expose you too, Greenson. And so that scared the psychiatrist. You see, not only is he sick and tired of, you know, treating her 6-7 days a week, it was really unwieldy for him. The thing that really put him over the top was that Bobby said that Greenson's affair was going to be exposed. And the fact is, Marilyn only intended on exposing Bobby and Jack. So, therefore, Bobby Kennedy used Greenson to get rid of Marilyn.
Now, Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, was the Attorney General at the time. Is that correct?
That's true.
Now, there's give us a sort of a step-by-step, as best as you can, to reconstruct the murder of Marilyn Monroe.
Sure.
Is it the guest cottage is where it started, or was she,
It was in the guest cottage.
Oh, okay.
So what happened was this. Before the ambulance was called, let me give you a little bit of background of this.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so she's on the phone with Jose Bolaños about 9:45 p.m. She's happily, you know, laughing with him and everything else. And then she says, I hear a noise. I'll be right back, she tells Bolaños. So she puts the phone down, and Bolaños says that she doesn't hang up the line, but she never comes back. And so she walks over to the guest cottage, and she sees that Bobby Kennedy is there with these two Los Angeles police officers, Archie Case and James Ahern, and she screams at them to get out of her house. You know, this is her house, and she doesn't want them there. They're looking for her little red diary. And so what happens is that Archie Case and James Ahern throw her on the bed, and Bobby Kennedy puts a pillow over her face so that she could stop screaming, because then the neighbors are going to hear.
Well, were there some neighbors that did hear, Jay, or some of her screams or not?
Well, what happened was that Mary W. Goody Coons Barnes, and this is the first time that neighbor's been named as in our book, she told the first officer at the scene, Sergeant Jack Clemens, she said that, I've seen Bobby Kennedy go into that house a dozen times. That definitely was him. I don't know who the other two men were, end quote. And so she knew that Bobby was going in there with these two men. And this was, you know, right around the time that she was having that phone call with Jose Bolaños. And so the handyman, Norman Jeffries, who is also the housekeeper's son-in-law, said that he and the housekeeper were kicked out by Bobby Kennedy and these two men. And so the two men went to the guest cottage, made a loud ruckus because they breaking open one of her filing cabinets trying to, you know, find this red diary. And that's when Marilyn comes over to investigate that noise, because Norman Jeffries and Mrs. Murray, the housekeeper, they stayed at Mary W. Goody Coons Barnes's house. It's just next door, right over at 12304 Fifth Helena Drive. It's literally just a couple steps away from Marilyn's house. And so they stay there while they wait for, you know, Kennedy, Case, and Ahern to leave. And so while they're subduing her.
Were they told to leave by Kennedy and the two detectives or what, the vice squad?
Yes, they were. Yes. Okay. Norman Jeffries said that they made it clear that they were to be gone. And so they left and they went to, you know, Mrs. Barnes's house.
Okay.
So now Kennedy, they made this huge noise. Marilyn's coming over to investigate the noise. And they grab Marilyn, throw her on the bed. Bobby Kennedy's holding a pillow over her face. They strip her of her clothes. She's like naked now. And Bobby says to her, to Case and Ahern, he says, give her something to calm her down. And so they give her these Nebutal injections. I interviewed a confidential source exclusively for this book in which we found out that the injections to calm her down were in the jugular vein in her neck and behind her knees. Okay? And so that didn't effectively subdue her because she's still hysterical. And so what they do is they decide to knock her out with a drug-laced enema full of 13 and 19 Nebutals and 17 chlorohydrates. This is before the ambulance is called. And so they're looking around for the diary. They cannot find it that whole night. So they're very frustrated. They leave. And then Jeffries and Mrs. Murray are over at Mrs. Barnes's house. They notice that the three men leave. And so they return. They notice that Marilyn's in the guest cottage, not in the main bedroom where they last saw her, and she's naked, and she's leaning on the phone, and she looks like she's barely breathing, and they know that she's over there because the dog, Math, is barking in the guest cottage. And so Mrs. Murray responsibly calls an ambulance and Schaefer ambulance, and there are 14 Schaefer attendants, including James Hall and Murray Leibowitz, who remember this call. In fact, I did an exclusive interview with Schaefer ambulance attendant Edgardo Villalobos, and he told me that he got the first call over at Beverly and Western, you know, with his driver, Larry Telling. But the reason they didn't pick up the call was because they're 15 miles away. They wouldn't have been able to get to Marilyn's house if they went 100 miles an hour. So Villalobos said that the call was transferred to James Hall and Murray Leibowitz over in Santa Monica. They were right around the corner. They responded within 2 minutes. And that's when they run into Greenson after they're trying to save her, and he just finishes her off with a heart needle.
Well, now, there's one other thing. Right before, supposedly, that they left, did they use a suppository up her?
No suppository. They used enema.
An enema to administer those last sedative drugs. Is that what they did?
They did. In fact, Marilyn had a prescription for chlorohydrate. There were like 50 pills. There were only 10 pills left. But, you know, the amount of drugs in her body, according to the toxicology reports, it says 8 milligrams percent of chlorohydrate. That's equivalent, and I'm trying to stress the word equivalent because we don't believe she swallowed these pills. We're saying it's the equivalent of 17 chlorohydrates.
Right. So that's why you're saying her stomach was empty. So they administered
yes.
it in the form of an enema, and this really knocked her out and put her very close to death. But when the ambulance finally got there, she was still breathing and still alive. Is that correct?
That's correct. And here's the strange thing, is that James Hall noticed that there was no indication of vomit.
Right.
There was no odor of drugs, no odor of pear. Odor of pear is like, you know, when you notice that there's a smell of chlorohydrate near your mouth. He said there was none of that.
Okay. Now, so after the ambulance is getting there, they put a resuscitator on her, and they get her to breathing, right? Then,
that's correct.
Then the psychiatrist, what's his name again?
Dr. Ralph Greenson.
Oh, okay. He comes in, And he's the one they had to take orders from because he's the doctor and a psychiatrist too, right?
That's correct.
So
in fact, James Paul.
He needed to give this injection, heart injection. Is that what he told them, so to speak?
He actually said to them, he said, that, according to James Hall, he said to him, I've got to make a show of this. So he's trying to pass it off like he's trying to save her with an adrenaline shot when he's really trying to kill her with an undiluted pentobarbital injection to the heart. When you don't fill the syringe with water first, it kills the patient within minutes.
I see. My father suffered from asthma all his life, and my mother had to learn how to give my father adrenaline shots to keep him alive and breathing. So when people are close to death, sometimes adrenaline can enhance the ability to continue the heartbeat and things like that and breathing, you know. It can be very helpful. So, after this injection, then she dies, and then what happens after that?
Well, what happens after that is that Greenson says, I'm going to pronounce her dead. You can leave. And so James Hall's like, wait a minute. You know, we were about to save her. He's just thinking in his mind, you know, if this guy hadn't come in there, we could have put her in the ambulance. She would be alive today. That was his strong belief, that but for Dr. Greenson coming in there, they could have saved her.
Right.
Her color was coming back and everything. But then he did suspiciously, Greenson's telling her, remove that resuscitator, which is the most suspicious thing in the world.
Right. Now, her close friends over the, that she had maintained over the years became suspicious of her death, right? And now,
yes,
there was there a cover-up of the autopsy and many of the details from the beginning after her death, or what? What occurred there? What could you?
Oh, definitely. In fact, the autopsy report did not. It claimed it had a handwritten statement that said no needle mark. That's incorrect. There's a needle mark in the heart. There's the needle mark behind the both knees. There's a needle mark to a jugular vein in her neck. There's another needle mark under her left armpit from when one of those two police officers, Kaser or Ahern, gave Marilyn an injection in the afternoon. There were witnesses that saw, including Mary W. Goody Coons Barnes, that saw like a guy with a medical bag in a suit, you know, come with Bobby Kennedy in the afternoon. And so she was given an injection in her left armpit in the afternoon. And so none of that was notated in the autopsy. Here's another thing, too. If you look at page 30 on my book, you'll see a picture of Marilyn face down on the bed.
Okay.
The only two bruises that are notated in the official autopsy report are on her lower back and then on the like on her hip. But there's actually a bruise on her upper back, which is not notated in the autopsy report. In fact, Noguchi himself, the autopsy surgeon, actually told biographers Peter Harry Brown and Patty Barham about arm bruises, bruises on her arms, but he didn't notate that in his autopsy report. So it's kind of strange how the autopsy surgeon is mentioning something that wasn't even notated in his own report.
Right.
In fact, James Hall said he was responsible for those bruises because he pulled her arms to pull her onto a hard surface so he could get her breathing again.
Right. What about the sound man? You have a chapter in there on the sound man. How does that figure in?
Well, this figures into nobody's ever interviewed him before. He actually went with Fred Otash the night that Marilyn died to remove all the bugs. That was his job. His job was not to move the body or do anything like that. His job was specifically to get rid of any bugs that he saw there. And he went there after Bobby left with Case and Ahern, and before Dr. Greenson injected her in the heart, and he was just rummaging around the house trying to get rid of these bugs. He confirmed to me that, yes, there was an affair between Marilyn Monroe and Jack Kennedy, and, yes, there was an affair between Marilyn Monroe and Bobby Kennedy, and this was on tapes, wiretaps that he heard. And he also said that the whole thing is that nobody cared about Marilyn when she was in distress. They just were worried about the political, you know, aspects of this. That's a very curious statement because his observation when he was on the scene was that nobody was trying to help her. Nobody's trying to save her life. They're just trying to fix this whole thing so that the Kennedys don't get messed up with it.
Yeah, it looked like Marilyn was a very beautiful lady and very well known and just a major star and very sexy and so forth. And they just used her and then at the end threw her away, didn't they?
Oh, they sure did. Uh-huh. In fact, you know, you were mentioning before how friends were being suspicious of the circumstances
yes.
of her death.
Yes.
Probably the most you know, the friend that was the most suspicious was her hairstylist since the Asphalt Jungle in 1950. His name is Sidney Guliroff. He said that on the last afternoon of her life, he got a call around 2:30 p.m. This was shortly after Bobby Kennedy left with, you know, one of the two officers in the afternoon, you know, because they tried to get her diary and they got screamed out of the house. They came back later, of course, in the evening. But during the afternoon, you know, Marilyn told Guliroff over the phone, she's crying, she's hysterical, you know. She had a big fight with Bobby Kennedy, and she said that Bobby Kennedy just left with Peter Lawford at her house. And, you know, Bobby Kennedy's not even supposed to be there. He's supposed to be in San Francisco. And so Guliroff is like, well, what is Bobby Kennedy doing at your house? And so Marilyn says, I'm having an affair with Jack Kennedy, and then I had an affair with Bobby Kennedy, and now everything has gone wrong. And so she said that that Bobby came there to tell her that that they don't want to hear from her anymore. And so, you know, Marilyn told Guliroff that she told Bobby, you know, what if I go public? You know, what if I hold a press conference? And so then Bobby Kennedy replied, according to Marilyn. She said, Bobby Kennedy said to Marilyn, if you threaten me, Marilyn, there's more than one way to keep you quiet. And so Marilyn is absolutely hysterical. I mean, she just is really scared. And so Guliroff is obviously surprised. He says, well, we'll talk later, you know, and maybe when you're calmed down and everything. He didn't know that the next day she'd be dead, but he was absolutely suspicious. He thought that the two events were absolutely related. It's no coincidence that here she is having, you know, this huge confrontation with Bobby Kennedy, and hours later she's dead.
Right. What was going on was did they use sort of national security to wiretap her, or who wiretapped her home there?
There were several different individuals that wiretapped her home. There's the CIA, the FBI, the mafia. In fact, Fred Otash, who was a private detective, he said that he bugged Marilyn's home initially on behalf of Jimmy Hoffa. But then he said that, you know, sometimes he would have three different clients, you know, for one tape. So he'd get paid three different times. You know, he'd be, like, giving a tape to Jimmy Hoffa. He'd be giving it to some other mafia people.
Okay.
Even 20th Century Fox was bugging her house. There's a CIA document dated August 3rd, 1962, which is one day before Marilyn's murdered. And on that document, it says that it's very clear from wiretaps that she is going to go public and to discuss her, quote, diary of secrets, end quote. That's how they refer to it in the CIA document. And that she's going to hold a, quote, tell-all press conference, end quote. And so it wasn't just like hearsay from any of her friends that she was going to hold a press conference. You see, Sidney Guliroff knew that she was going to hold a press conference. Peter Lawford said that she was going to hold a press conference. That CIA document one day before she died said that she was going to hold a press conference, and the CIA said they knew this because of wiretaps on her home.
Right. At the top of the power structure, with J. Edgar Hoover knowing about this and other people, was J. Edgar Hoover and the Kennedy boys, brothers, they were at odds with each other. Would that be a correct statement?
Oh, definitely. You know, I mean, it's just they didn't like each other at all, and that was probably a bad move on Bobby's part. He didn't realize how powerful Hoover was. And see, Chief William Parker, who was Bobby Kennedy's friend, he had promised him, Parker, that he would, you know, replace Hoover. But now they couldn't replace, you know, Hoover because Hoover had all this information on him. You know, there's this letter that Hoover wrote to Bobby Kennedy on July 8th, 1964, and he's talking about Frank Capel's, you know, soon-to-be-released The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe, and he says, quote, Hoover wrote, his book will make reference to your alleged friendship with the late Miss Marilyn Monroe. Mr. Capel stated that he will indicate in his book that you and Miss Monroe were intimate and that you were in Miss Monroe's home at the time of her death, end quote. And so there's even a neighbor of Hoover's who Hoover told the neighbor that she was murdered, that Marilyn Monroe was not a suicide, that the Kennedys were involved. And J. Edgar Hoover told this to a teenage neighbor, Anthony Calamaris.
My gosh. So she happened to be a victim. She did fall in love with John Kennedy and then later Bobby. Now, on what date did Bobby break off with her? When did that occur before her passing, before her death? How does that relate?
Okay, so before I mention that, it began like right after the birthday gala, you know, when he's trying to, you know, tell her that she can't see Jack Kennedy anymore.
That would be in May of 60.
May of 62 until around, and then the day of her death, he breaks it off. That's when he breaks it off, just hours before her death.
Okay.
You know, 2 p.m., like about 2 p.m., he comes to her house and says, we don't want to hear from you anymore. We don't want any more letters. We don't want any more phone calls. Stop calling the Department of Justice. Stop calling, you know, the White House. We don't want to hear from you anymore. And so that's when, you know, she resumed her threats to go public. And that's when, you know, Bobby Kennedy got Greenson involved. And Greenson was the one that eventually ended her life.
Well, okay.
But you see, Bobby Kennedy tricked Greenson into thinking that Marilyn would go public with Greenson.
Right.
But the truth is that Marilyn was only going to go public with Bobby and Jack. You know, Bobby just made Greenson think that his affair would be exposed, too.
Right. You say down here, Walt Schaefer's involvement. What was his involvement in this?
His involvement was that Bobby Kennedy told Walt Schaefer, he said, look, you know, if you don't want to stick to the story that we're going to tell you, then we're going to ruin your business. We know that you have a lot of Hollywood people that work for you, and you're not going to get all that private service anymore, and then your business will just go, you know, belly up. And so he agreed to a story, but he retracted that story. Walt Schaefer retracted it shortly before he died in the late 80s, and he said the reason he lied was because he was worried that, you know, his business would be ruined.
Now, he was in the business of what in Hollywood? What did Walt Schaefer do?
He did Schaefer Ambulance. He was the president of Schaefer Ambulance.
Okay, so that's the ambulance that went out there that made the call on Marilyn's home there at the guest cottage. So she actually died in the guest cottage.
That is correct.
And this is where they found her, you know, and that's where the photographs were made and so forth. How about
her body was later moved into her main bedroom to, you know, quote unquote, stage it as if it were a suicide, which
it
most definitely wasn't.
Too, some of the bottles that they said that the pills that she took, they were screwed on. The caps were screwed on very neatly, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's going to commit suicide, you think they're going to screw on the caps all neatly? It doesn't make any sense.
No. And who was Ken Hunter in the involvement? Who was Ken Hunter?
Okay, Ken Hunter was a guy who claimed he was a Schaefer ambulance attendant who claimed that he went with Murray Leibowitz. But there's many problems with that. I interviewed Schaefer Vice President Carl Balanzi, and he told me that Ken Hunter didn't even start working for Schaefer until the mid-1970s, which is years after Marilyn died, and that even when he did, he worked in Orange County, never in Los Angeles. And he said that Ken Hunter was known for telling a lot of tall tales, like an old-time cedar. And here's what's interesting about Ken Hunter, is that he said that his partner was Murray Leibowitz. Okay, so Murray Leibowitz is dead, and he changed his name to Murray Lieb. I interviewed his widow, Sylvia Lieb, and she told me exclusively that even though she disagrees with James Hall's account, she said, yes, James Hall did go with her husband because she remembers seeing James Hall on television. Ken Hunter was never on television, and you know, so that's what's really peculiar about it is that, you know, here she is, you know, saying that, no, Ken Hunter was not the guy that went with my husband. You know, in fact, Murray Leibowitz told Donald Wolfe in 1993 that, yes, James Hall went with me. So even he himself said that James Hall went with him and that, yes, his account about Greenson and the heart needle is accurate. He told this to Donald Wolfe in 1993.
Did Schaefer Ambulance, did they operate just in the L.A. area, or were they also in San Francisco?
Just in the Los Angeles area and surrounding areas, not in San Francisco.
But not in San Francisco. Now, later that evening, when the night that Marilyn died, was there a stop out on the freeway?
You're referring to Detective Lynn Franklin. He was 40 years old at the time that he pulled over a drunk Peter Lawford in a Lincoln Continental sedan. He was going 80 miles an hour with the headlights off, driving really erratically. And so right at the intersection of Olympic and Robertson Boulevard, he pulls over Peter Lawford. He says, "Hey, Pete, what are you doing? Your headlights are off and you're going crazy fast." And so Pete says, "I got to get the attorney general, you know, checked out of the Beverly Hilton Hotel, and there's only a few more minutes before his plane leaves." And so, you know, Lynn Franklin says, "Well, you know, you wouldn't have gotten there going this way because you're heading towards downtown Los Angeles." And so at that moment, Bobby Kennedy says to Peter Lawford, he says, "I told you, stupid." And so, you know, Lynn Franklin flashes a flashlight in the front seat next to Peter, and he notices that Dr. Ralph Greenson is there. He knows it's Dr. Greenson because, you know, when the funeral happened on August 8th, he looked at funeral footage, and he saw Greenson in the funeral footage, and he says, "Yeah, that's the guy that was sitting next to Lawford that night when I pulled him all over." In fact, Lawford said, "Oh, don't worry. He's just a doctor. He's riding along with us."
So this was late that evening, 11 something. What time was that? Approximately?
They were pulled over about 12:10 a.m. on August 5th, 1962, which is about 4 hours before Greenson officially calls the police. And that's about 20 minutes after Greenson injects her in the heart. So what are these guys doing 7 miles from her house 20 minutes after she's killed by Greenson?
Right.
It's almost like a joke, you know. They're completely caught red-handed.
Right. But these people were in power, so they had the ability to squash the autopsy and things like that early on. So the public never got wind of this. Now I heard rumors, though. Of course, I was, you know, I'm 70 years old, so you know I remember all these events. But I remember mm-hmm. rumors coming out at one time, maybe after one of the earlier books, about that they killed her with an enema type of operation there at the end. And I heard that Kennedy was involved, Bobby Kennedy was involved. But this was years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a purplish discoloration of her colon.
Yes.
That was from the drug-laced enema. In fact, the deputy district attorney, John Miner, who investigated this case, he strongly believed that she was somehow, you know, put in that situation because of a drug enema. He hypothesized it was just a Nebutal enema, but I argue that chlorohydrate was included in that enema.
Right. I mean, in other words, that's what put her under, right? I mean, for sure.
That's correct.
And if she hadn't gotten, what, any kind of help at all, she would have died probably within hours, would you think, or not?
Oh, sure. I mean, if Mrs. Murray had not responsibly called the ambulance,
right.
You see, none of the principals at the scene even expected her to do that. So it was almost like the scandal was unraveling before their eyes, and they had to, you know, put a stop to this. So they, you know, got Greenson, and they said, "Hey, you know, you're the doctor. You're going to look like you're saving her, but you're really going to kill her."
Right.
And that was almost an ingenious way to do it because there were five eyewitnesses, and, you know, three of the five say that Greenson stuck this heart needle in her. So that's really quite compelling, if you ask me.
Later that year, I think in the fall of the year, was the Cuban crisis, I believe, if I remember correctly. And
mm-hmm.
and then I think I went in the Army on January of 63, and went into the Army Security Agency. And then, of course, LBJ was already president by then, see. So do you think there were – I've heard over the years that there were two factions that were fighting for power. There was the Kennedy faction, and then there was this other faction, maybe with LBJ and other players involved. What would you think about something like that going on behind the scenes at that time?
Well, you know, like when – President Jack Kennedy was killed, it was definitely orchestrated by LBJ. You know, the man who I believe killed Jack Kennedy is James Sutton, who's, you know, goes by James Files. He's in prison in Illinois State Penitentiary for shooting two police officers in a completely unrelated charge. But he has confessed to the crime. FBI agent Zach Shelton believes him, and a number of other FBI agents believe his confession because, you know, once anybody confesses, you got to see if they're like a clown or not, you know? And everything that he says correlates with that whole power structure. In fact, you know, LBJ wanted to be president. That was like his lifelong dream, was to become president of the United States. And that's what happened. He ended up, you know, becoming president because of this coup d'etat that happened.
Right. The we had last November, we had a JFK conference up in the Dallas area, and Judith Berry Baker and also Chris Milligan were the producers of that particular conference, and we went there and we listened. We did a live webcast of the event. There's a 3-day event. And so we heard a lot of the speakers that are bringing up very important points now about the JFK assassination and so forth. Do you think that these men, all these men that we're talking about, lived by the sword and they sort of died by the sword, huh, in a way, or what?
Yeah, in a way, that's very true. In fact, you know, you knew that the JFK assassination is related to the Robert Kennedy assassination, right?
Yes.
I mean, the two are very, like, related as far as the CIA goes. In fact, there's a 19-page postscript in my book in which we talk about a possible third shooter. In fact, I don't want to say possible because we pretty much prove it, is that, you know, there was a second shooter of Robert Kennedy in addition to Sirhan, like a security guard behind Kennedy, who actually drew his gun and shot him twice to the right armpit, and then a third shooter who was a Ku Klux Klansman, he shot him in the back of the head. And that's why the security guard said he got powder burns in his eyes. You see, this is really just unbelievable. This is the first time that this third shooter has ever been mentioned. His name has never been mentioned in any Robert Kennedy assassination book that's ever been written. And so, you know, we put together who he was, and I did a first-time interview with Irene Gizzi. She was 28 at the time. She's Youth for Kennedy chairman in Panorama City, and she said she saw a 5-person group downstairs in the ambassador room shortly before the shooting upstairs in the pantry. So she saw a 5-person group, including, you know, the person we name as the third shooter. She called him the medallion guy because he was wearing this big, flashy medallion. The medallion guy's girlfriend was the polka dot dress girl, Catherine Ainsworth. She was a Ku Klux Klansman, just like the medallion guy. And the other three people in this 5-person group were three CIA agents, CIA agent George Ioannidis, CIA agent David Sanchez Morales, and CIA agent James Hardesty Critchfield, who was the CIA chief in the Middle East at that time that Bobby was shot.
Right.
And in, you know, so this was very curious. What are all these people doing in the Ambassador Hotel? You know, two of them have, you know, like, cover names. And so you got to wonder, this is not just some coincidence, you know?
Right. So Bobby had started running for the presidency at the time. Is that correct?
Yes, he had won the primary, you know, that
right.
night. And so it's just, you know, he would have become president of the United States very possibly. He had such popularity, you know, with his issues on civil rights, you know, aligning with Cesar Chavez. I mean, he was like a golden boy, you know.
Right, and of course, the public didn't know about anything of his involvement with Marilyn Monroe, or that would have been over for him, of course, you know, murder charges.
That's true. They tried to expose it. In 1966, right around December of 1966, in New York, Bernie Spindell, who, you know, was Fred Otash's boss, who I mentioned before, Fred Otash, who bugged Marilyn's house, you know, he worked for Bernie Spindell. So Spindell had copies of the tapes that were running that captured Bobby at Marilyn's house before, during, and after she died. And so, you know, the district attorney's office in New York raided Bernie Spindell's house in 1966. You know, this is 2 years before Bobby gets murdered. And they took his whole file on Marilyn Monroe that would have proven that Bobby was there and everything. And so people say, well, wasn't this going to come out, you know, with him, you know, being recorded there? I mean, they got rid of that threat in 1966. They destroyed all those tapes, at least on Bernie Spindell's end of it. You know, Fred Otash still had copies of the tapes. I interviewed Jane Mansfield's press secretary, Raymond Strait, and he knew Fred Otash for 20 years. And Fred Otash told Raymond Strait, he said, look, he said in 1976, he said, here, hold on to these tapes. So he held on to them until 1986. And then in 1986, Raymond Strait heard 11 hours that were running before, during, and after she was killed. And he heard, you know, Case and Ahern, you know, the two cops with Kennedy, you know, like saying to each other, give her another one. Don't give it to her too soon. and there were like these awful smothering sounds. You know, Raymond Straight said it sounded like somebody was placing a pillow over her face. According to Bernie Spindell and handwritten notes released by Fred Otash, this was Bobby Kennedy who was putting the pillow over her face.
Oh, my gosh. It's so ugly, isn't it, huh?
Yes, very, very ugly.
And what do they end up with? They become president of the United States and this and that, but it's a fake. It's a false. It's a hollow wind, it seems like to me.
Oh, definitely. And if you think that it was strange that Bobby became less ruthless after Jack died, I think that just got rid of his whole ruthless bug. You know, he became a kinder and gentler person, apparently. You know, and he actually said to people, they say, well, why don't you have more protection around you? And he says, well, if they're going to get me, they're going to get me. And they sure did.
Now, Sirhan, inside that hotel or that back kitchen area, he was just a setup guy. Isn't that right? He was just...
That's correct. There were a lot of people that said that he was firing blanks, but that's not true because then there wouldn't be enough bullets to go around. There's an audio recording by Stanislav Brzezinski, which actually captures 13 shot sounds. You know, so Sirhan only had 8 shots in his Ira Johnson revolver, which was a .22, and that security guard behind Kennedy actually had a 9-shot .22, and he lied and said he brought a Rome 38 instead, but that's not true. He brought his, you know, .22. And so he shot Kennedy twice to the right armpit, and then, you know, the medallion guy shot him in the back of the head.
With those shots, he didn't die right then, did he? It took a day or so for Kennedy to die, or what?
That is correct. He died at 1:44 a.m. the next morning.
Oh, okay.
And you know, it looked pretty much like he was a vegetable. I mean, they couldn't save him. That wound to the head was really severe, and that was, you know, causing him a lot of distress. He would have survived had he not been shot in the head. You see, the 2 shots to the right armpit, that's why the security guard is not the murderer. A lot of people were saying that the security guard fired all 3 shots. That's not true. He only fired the first 2.
Right.
And then the medallion guy came in and shot him in the back of the head.
Yeah, I see. And this medallion guy was with the polka dot lady, is that right?
Yes, that was his girlfriend. They were lovers.
Oh, I see.
And so Catherine Ainsworth was the polka dot dress girl. And we know this because Irene Gizzi picked him out of a photo lineup, the 2 of them, the medallion guy and the polka dot dress girl. She's the first person to do that in history because nobody's ever shown people a photo lineup to pick these people out. You know, and so she picked him out, and she became the first person in history to actually identify them.
You know, one of the reasons, very good research there, one of the reasons that we're talking about this is that we need to inform the American public of the way that these people really are, you know?
Yeah.
And they're striving for power and for the presidency and all that, and they become ruthless and they become bloodthirsty and they become killers in this case, see? So here we have, you know, the Kennedys, JFK and his brother. But before that, then you had the Maryland murder, see? And so
mm-hmm.
Are there any good players in this thing? When you reach a certain level of American politics today, are there any good guys or not? What do you think?
Well, it is very difficult to determine because you never know what's happening behind the scenes. You see, that's what's clearly being proven here, is that at the time, everyone thought that Bobby Kennedy is such a great person. He's helping minorities, he's helping Cesar Chavez, you know, he's helping all these different people, and he's, you know, becoming kinder and gentler, but that was just because his brother was killed. You know, that's what I strongly believe, is that his brother being killed just kind of turned this different switch off in his head that just said, you know, I'm not going to be so ruthless anymore, because he really was ruthless.
Did his adversaries, if Bobby Kennedy had become president, then he would have conducted an investigation of JFK's assassination, or what? Is that what the cartel that took out JFK had to stop? Is that it?
Well, they probably did believe that because, you know, in private, you know, Robert Kennedy definitely believed there was a conspiracy. He thought that the Warren Commission was a sham, you know, but he couldn't say that in public, you know, because that would make him look strange. Because he's always trying to maintain the government order, but he wanted to figure out who did this. He knew that the CIA was most likely involved. And so, and he was also very suspicious of LBJ, definitely.
It looks like the JFK thing was a sea change in American politics. And then also the biggest one event and the most evil event has been 9/11, it looks like to me. Okay.
Oh, that is extremely evil.
Because what that's done is that has been a tool. Whatever side you come down on 9/11, the event itself has been used to take the American public freedoms and liberties away. What do you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you see, there's always these situations where they say, oh, we should lessen gun control and everything. But, you know, I personally believe that people have the right to the Second Amendment to protect themselves. I mean, you hear these stories, just general stories in the media about, like, an 11-year-old kid who actually knew how to operate, you know, his uncle's shotgun and killed, like, a burglar that came in. I mean, if you take away the rights for people to have guns, you're going to see cases where people just can't defend themselves.
Yeah, the NRA has always stated that there's virtually hundreds of thousands, maybe into the millions. It's a hard figure to get to. There are many cases where brandishing a weapon kept a crime from happening and also kept a murder and protected the man brandishing the gun. But some of these states have these crazy laws about brandishing, and they've gone over the top in punishing people that have guns, it looks like to me.
Yeah, and that's what I really disagree with. I just don't think that people should have guns taken away from them. You know, like liberals, they try to make that sound like, you know, oh, if you take away the guns and there'll be no more gun problem. That's not true. You know, if somebody's going to get a gun, they're going to get it illegally, you know?
I think there have been studies where the most strict gun control measures, laws that exist, you have some of the highest gun violence. And some of those areas that I've interviewed people over the years that are experts in this area, and that's what they've come up with. I can't recall the PhD that has the best handle on this. He's from the Chicago area. But when people know that they might get shot, they're going to refrain from crime. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
It's a deterrent. You know what I mean? And
definitely,
especially we learned down here in Texas that if you're out on a ranch or a farm by yourself and you get jumped by someone, you better be able to protect yourself. See what I mean?
Because they'll take advantage of you if they think you don't have like a gun to, you know,
if you're disarmed,
put in their face.
They've got you. They got the drop on you, as the old saying goes. And then,
that's it.
That's the end of it could be the end of your life. But if you're armed,
and that's why those stories about, you know, like the kid who has his uncle's gun, that stuff rings true.
Yes.
In more ways than one, you know.
Yes, it does. And what calls to my attention is the L.A. area is so big out there, and it's almost becoming unlawful in a way, you know. And it's got its problems, you know. And so I don't know what's going to happen to the country as a whole, you know. I'm very worried.
I'm very frightened too, because, you know, there's a lot of people who are mentally ill, you know, and perhaps they're not like evil people,
right,
but they become evil by their actions, and, you know, and so a lot of these criminals are mentally ill.
Yeah.
I'm not like exonerating any of them, believe me, but I'm just saying that, you know, there's a bunch of them that are ill. And then there's just a bunch of them who are sociopaths, and you need, like, a gun to defend yourself, and you can't take that right away from people, especially since it's the Second Amendment.
Right. We've got about 4.5 minutes left for this interview. Is there anything that you can recall that you would like to, any final statements or final conclusions that you would make? You've got four minutes here to speak some out. You know.
Okay, sure. Just about the Robert Kennedy assassination, you know, my book, along with Richard Buskin, my co-author, a New York Times bestselling author, this is the first book, our book, to actually name the medallion guy. And so nobody else has ever done that before. And so it's historical because he is the true murderer of Robert Kennedy. It was not the security guard, as previous books have argued. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have studied this case. You know, Robert Joling was a judge, and he passed away in 2013. He thought the security guard did all three shots. That's not correct.
Now, this book is out right now, or is it about to come out?
That is correct. It came out June 3rd, 2014. It's currently out.
Okay.
And it's been out for quite some time. And that 19-page chapter, you know, definitely gets people's attention because it's not just about Marilyn. Once you're done reading about Marilyn, you can, you know, turn to page 169, and there's the postscript about how Robert Kennedy died.
Okay, so this Marilyn Monroe book does have some Bobby Kennedy assassination in there also, right?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Well, man, that makes it a very, very good purchase then, because you're getting a lot of very good information in there. And what else could you say about this overall Marilyn Monroe episode and the Bobby Kennedy? And how about John? What happened up there in Massachusetts? Do you have any information on that or not?
I haven't studied that, but I definitely think that's very suspicious. Definitely not something that was just like a,
there was,
you know.
There was a reporter. I got right on top of that when it happened.
Uh-huh.
And there was a reporter on Baffin Beach, okay? And
uh-huh.
He saw a light, a flash of a light at that time when he was flying in. And then later on, I don't know how many days later, his sister-in-law, John's sister-in-law's suitcase floated into that beach, okay? The rest of the
wow.
plane was found in a different location, I mean, where they think it went, of course, went down after maybe a bomb went off or he, you know, crashed or something, see? So there's indication maybe that there was a bomb in the baggage department, compartment, and that's why it blew her particular baggage away from the plane, see?
I find it strange how he just dies so young. I mean, here he was a handsome guy. He's on top of the world. He's
right.
ready to, you know, I mean, he really was much beloved by the media.
Wasn't he exposing some of these conspiratorial type of exposures of some of these inside power plays and stuff? And maybe that's one, but he was going to run for the Senate of the U.S. Senate in New York. I think that's what I've heard. Have you heard that?
Yeah. I've heard those things too, and you know, I guess now that he's gone, you know, we won't know exactly everything about all that, but it's definitely worth, you know, putting under scrutiny for sure.
He's one of the Kennedys that I never heard anything bad said about him. So evidently,
that too, but me too. You know,
I think he was a pretty good guy overall, and I think he treated his wife and his friends and everything else pretty well. So,
and that's why it's such a shame that he's gone.
What is your
really
website
terrible.
That you can go to get this information?
Well, you can email me. Any of the listeners can email me at MarilynMonroe1962@outlook.com.
Okay.
If they have questions,
okay.
You know, MarilynMonroe1962@outlook.com. My co-author, Richard Buskin. You know, he has his website, so.
Okay, well, we'll put that one up, too. We want to thank you for being with us this evening, and thank you very much, Jay Margolis, for doing all this fine work on the Marilyn and also the Bobby Kennedy assassination. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, George, for having me.
Thank you.